Is the food you eat genetically modified? The answer, at some level, is probably yes. Scientists are hard at work creating hamburger in a lab and chicken in a test tube. That's not available yet. But 88% of all the corn planted in the U.S. last year was, in some way, genetically modified. And 93% of all the soybeans. Humans don't actually consume any of that, but a lot of it is turned into feed for the meat that we do eat. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld, and this is Central Standard. We'll talk more about genetically modified crops later in the show. But what worries many people right now is that we have no idea what genetically modified food we're actually consuming. Over the last year or so, at least 20 states have introduced bills that would require labeling of genetically modified food. Some of these proposed laws, including one in Missouri, go beyond crops and take aim specifically at genetically engineered meat or fish. And that got Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress-Swanson wondering, how close are we to actually eating genetically engineered animals? What she found out might surprise you. We'll talk to Abby in just a few minutes, but now let's hear her report.
Oh, here's a neat guy. This cell is wanting to become a neuron.
Kevin Wells is a scientist at the University of Missouri, Columbia, and is a leading national expert on genetic engineering in animals. In his clean, fluorescent-lit lab full of buzzing half-size incubators, Wells is looking through the microscope at a cluster of cells. These are from the tail of a pig.
So if you look in the dead center, you'll see a cell that looks like a star, sending its projections out to go make connections.
I'm getting a lesson in how genetically engineered, or GE, animals are made. Basically, by pulling apart segments of DNA and putting them back together in different orders. Science fiction this is not. Right here in central Missouri, Wells and other scientists are creating mice, pigs, and rats that will, say, be resistant to swine flu or produce their own nutrients. Wells has been on the GE front line for 24 years, including early work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
When I was at USDA, we made cattle that were resistant to Staph aureus mastitis. It's not very often that you get to say you cured a disease. But because of the fear of public perception, those animals, no one's even attempted to take them to market.
Wells has even gotten death threats based on what might come out of his lab. Opponents argue there are too many risks and too many unknowns associated with GE animals. They've got questions about animal welfare, food safety, human health impacts, whether these animals could escape, spread diseases, and then there's a labeling issue. In Missouri, Senator Jamila Nasheed has introduced a bill that would require GE poultry and fish to be labeled as such. Here's Nasheed on the Senate floor.
I'm not saying that genetically modified foods are good or bad, but what I am saying is that the foods that are genetically modified by way of meats and fish should be labeled.
But isn't this all hypothetical? After my tour of the lab, I asked Wells, are there any genetically engineered animals on the market for human consumption?
The rumor mill suggests there is one genetically engineered tilapia that is available for consumption in Cuba. But no, there are none approved in Europe. There are none for human consumption. And there are none approved in the United States for consumption. There is a genetically engineered goat that has been approved for FDA to produce a pharmaceutical in its milk.
But the GE waters are churning when it comes to salmon. The Food and Drug Administration is right now considering whether to allow a genetically engineered Atlantic salmon on the U.S. market. Wells was one of three scientists selected to be on a committee that evaluated the so-called Aqua Advantage salmon for the FDA. The GE salmon feeds year-round, and therefore it grows faster.
So it reaches market weight in about a year and a half, as opposed to 3 years. And it does that on 80% of the feed.
The GE salmon eggs are now being produced in Canada and then shipped to a plant in Panama where they are raised and processed. The FDA issued a preliminary ruling in December that the GE salmon is as safe as conventional Atlantic salmon and that there will be no harmful environmental impacts. Yet, the FDA has received thousands of comments opposing the GE salmon. The Center for Food Safety, a nonprofit advocacy group, has released a video opposing the salmon. Here's a clip featuring the group's director, Andrew Kimbrell.
So once we were to release a genetically engineered striped bass or Atlantic salmon into a river system like this, even by accident, that terrible arithmetic of extinction would begin. And within a few generations, they would become extinct, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Wells calls arguments like these silly, but he understands the fears.
There are risks associated with everything. Every time we eat anything, whether it's from a factory farm or it's from an organic producer down the street, there are risks associated with it. And this is, again, this is new. So it's difficult for people.
Whether states mandate labels or not, the FDA says that if it approves the GE salmon, it will issue guidance on labeling for all genetically engineered animals for human consumption. There's just nothing else on the table yet. Abby Fencher-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Abby Fencher-Swanson joins us now from KBIA in Columbia. Abby, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So, Abby, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that we could see genetically engineered fish on the dinner table at some point here in the near future?
Yeah, and that's if the FDA approves this application. As I said, the public comment period closed at the end of April, and actually from what I've read, they received 1.8 million comments opposing this salmon. So whether or not the FDA approves it kind of remains to be seen. The company who applied for this salmon, Aqua Bounty, expects an approval this September. And if they do get that, then it would be whether or not, you know, companies could sue them saying that they don't want the salmon on the market. But if it does sort of come onto the market, it would be imported here from Panama, and then retailers would have to actually carry it. Right now, there are a bunch of retailers who have said, including Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, who have said they will not carry it. So kind of remains to be seen. This application has been in the works for 18 years, so we'll see what happens.
So aside from the super salmon, what other products might be genetically modified, either currently or in the near future?
Well, there's no GE meat on the market, and this salmon would be the first animal that's genetically engineered. And by genetically engineered, we mean actually changing, altering the genetic material of that animal through genetic engineering. So there could be, and in fact there is, maybe 70% of what you see in the grocery store today is genetically modified. If it's meat, a lot of animals, most animals have eaten genetically modified grains. In the produce section, you might find genetically modified squash or papaya. And then all throughout the supermarket aisles, there are things that contain products from GE corn. If there's any corn syrup in it, it's likely that's GE corn. Or as you said in your lead, GE soybeans. So there's a lot in the supermarket right now that does contain genetically modified organisms or GMOs. There's also a lot of legislation that's been introduced that would require this to be labeled if the legislation passes.
So we briefly mentioned this before, speaking of labeling, but there's this proposed law in the Missouri State Senate that would require genetically engineered meat or fish to be labeled. So what's the status of that legislation here in Missouri?
Yeah, Senate Bill 155 was introduced back in January by a senator from St. Louis, Jamila Nasheed, and nothing's really happened since it's been introduced. It has been referred to committee, but we're sort of waiting to hear more. The bill really targets genetically engineered poultry, of which there is none on the market, and genetically engineered fish. And it wouldn't require labeling until 2015. So it's really a preemptive strike. And we'll have to wait and see again what happens with that. And there are also about 20 other states considering mandatory labeling for GE products. And in fact, at the end of April, a federal law was introduced that would require labeling on all genetically engineered foods except meat, I believe, is how it reads right now. So again, we'll just have to see what happens.
And this legislation in Missouri that's pending, it wouldn't require any labeling of other genetically modified products. We're just talking about meat or fish here.
That's correct.
Supermarket chain Whole Foods announced back in March that by 2018, all genetically modified products, all of them in its stores, will be labeled. So what's that about?
Yeah, so this was a really big deal because no other retailer has ever announced anything like this or committed to any kind of labeling. But basically, they've said by 2018 that all of their products will have a label as to whether or not they contain GMOs, genetically modified organisms. That would include meat that you buy from the butcher at Whole Foods. So if these animals had eaten genetically modified feed, which, as I said, most of them currently do, then that would be labeled as containing GMOs. So it's a pretty big deal. As I said, things that have been genetically modified are in most of the grocery store aisles, like over 70% of products in grocery stores are genetically modified. So it's a pretty big commitment from Whole Foods. We'll have to see if they actually, stick to that rule and if it is something they actually do by 2018, given that it is such a major move.
Abby Fentress-Swanson is a reporter for Harvest Public Media based at KBIA in Columbia. Abby, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Harvest Public Media is based here at KCUR, and it's a collaboration between 9 public media stations across the Midwest that covers food and food production. You can learn more at harvestpublicmedia.org. You're listening to Central Standard right now on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. Today we're talking about the science behind genetically modified food. But I want to know from you, Kansas City. Are you concerned about eating genetically modified food? Why or why not? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'd like to bring in another voice now. Allison Van Inenam studies animal genomics and biotechnology at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Van Inenam, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Food production is a high-tech process these days. So what is your field, biotechnology, and how is it used to produce the food we eat?
Well, as you have alluded to already, it's used very extensively in crop production, and specifically we're talking genetic engineering today. Genetic modification is a kind of a more ambiguous term, I guess, so I'm going to stick with genetic engineering. But as you mentioned, a lot of soy and corn and several other crops that are grown in production agriculture have been genetically engineered, and about 70% of the processed foods in the supermarket contain ingredients that are derived from genetically engineered crops. And, of course, the biggest consumer of genetically engineered crops are our livestock production animals.
And so what's the science behind genetic engineering? You know, how does it actually work? If I wanted to, say, genetically engineer something, how does that happen?
Well, basically, depending upon what trait you wanted to express or what you wanted the particular organism to do, you would take a piece of DNA that contains the gene of interest, and you can use recombinant DNA technology to put that gene into the genome of the organism you want to modify. Let's talk about fish, for example, such that then it would express that one protein. It's quite a precise process because you know exactly which one protein you're putting in amongst the 30,000 or so that the fish would normally produce, and you can basically tailor it to turn on in a particular situation. In the case of the fish, for example, as was mentioned, it's basically turned on in response to cold water. And so basically what that does is it turns on that particular protein such that the fish is going to eat more consistently throughout the entire year and get to market weight in about half the time, which has the benefit of the fish doesn't require as much feed to get to market weight. And so it's actually a more efficient fish, if you will.
So humans have been selecting traits in animals that they've been breeding for centuries now. How is genetic modification or genetic engineering different from selective breeding?
Well, you're very right about what we've been doing with animal breeding. For example, if you look at the milk production of the current dairy cow versus 1950s, we've increased the productivity of that animal over 300% based on basically selecting parents that have optimum production characteristics and breeding them together to ever get offspring that are genetically improved. The difference there is you're basically mixing up, the thousands of genes of the two individuals and hoping that you get an offspring that on average is better than the average of the parents, versus genetic engineering, where you're very precisely taking a single protein or gene and inserting it into the genome, and you have control over the expression of that protein as a result of that. So it's really a more controlled form of breeding, if you will, and it's obviously something that you can use to both enhance productivity, but as was mentioned earlier, also engineer some really valuable traits like disease resistance in our livestock populations, which I think most people would think that would be a desirable thing if you've got less animal disease, less animal suffering, less use of antibiotics, I would argue a more sustainable animal production system. So there's a lot of different uses that you could use it for that you can't necessarily tackle using conventional breeding. For example, disease resistance is, you may not have that genetic diversity in your gene pool, and you can bring in outside genes that would give you virus resistance to foot and mouth disease, for example, and that would be a tremendous benefit that you can only achieve using genetic engineering.
So here's the $60 billion question. How safe are genetically engineered foods? You know, is it safe to eat a steak that was raised on genetically modified corn?
So, yeah, I mean, all of the data, as a scientist, you know, I have to go by what the data shows. And we've had 20 years of consumption of genetically engineered crops in the U.S., and there's been literally hundreds of scientific studies that have been done. And every major food safety organization in the world, the World Health Organization, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association, have all independently reached exactly the same conclusion, and that is that eating foods made from genetic engineered ingredients are safe, are in fact substantially equivalent to conventional alternatives. And so as a scientist, I just have to go with that data. I know that's not what you find if you Google it on the internet, but the scientific data shows that. And with regards to animals that are eating genetically engineered foods, and of course they are, because soy and corn is you know, a large part of the diet of many of our livestock animals, they digest the protein and the DNA that's in genetically engineered corn just the same as they do the corn protein and DNA, just the same as when we eat a fish, we digest the fish DNA and protein, and we don't turn into fish. We digest it, and it gets metabolized in our body. And so there's no studies showing there's any health effects to the animals from eating this feed, and there's absolutely no way you could tell if an animal had eaten genetically engineered food. It doesn't change the meat or the milk or the egg. There's no DNA or protein in those products. And so it's quite intriguing to me. I wasn't aware of the fact that Whole Foods is going to label animals that have eaten genetically engineered feed, because really the vast majority of our animal feed is going to be from genetically engineered crops. And there's really going to be no way to tell whether an animal's eaten one or not. And so somehow you're going to have to trace that whole supply chain and to be able to correctly label it. And that's no mean undertaking if you think of how long animals are around, you know, a couple of years, and tracking all of the feed that that animal's eating to ensure none of it's genetically engineered is a very costly proposition.
So when you were entering science, I understand that you considered pursuing working with GE animals for studying, but you opted for something slightly different. So what is that, and why did you end up kind of choosing a different tack?
So, true, my training, I'm a molecular geneticist, and I was trained in genetically engineered animals and was going to pursue that. But given the public concern about genetically engineered animals, and as you discussed earlier, the long protracted regulatory process to get even one animal to market has been in FDA review for over 18 years, it's effectively stalled public investment and private interest in the development of genetically engineered animals in the U.S. And as a consequence, it was quite difficult to get grant funding for that. And as a scientist, your lab depends on being able to have a fundable area. And so I moved to using the DNA information that's contained within an animal to make better selection decisions. It's a process called genomic selection. And it's really capitalizing on the investments that we've made in sequencing the bovine genome, for example, such that we can actually use that information to select cattle that are better suited to our production environment, so more feed efficient or more disease resistant, and basically utilizing the natural variation that exists in the cattle population to try to produce an animal that's more efficient and is able to produce beef, if you will, with less feed and in a more healthy fashion. So that's certainly, you know, that is an option. I think to me, genetic engineering is another tool in that genetic toolbox, and I don't think that it should be forbidden based on non-scientific issues, because really I think it has tremendous potential for certain traits that we can't really select for using natural variation in the population.
Okay, well, Allison, I'm gonna take a phone call here from
sure.
Nick from Parkville. Hi, Nick. You're on Central Standard.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your taking the call. Let me preface my comment by saying I come from a family of vegans who's been very concerned about biology. However, as I've looked into GMOs, I'm struck by a number of things which seem to lose attention in the public focus. For example, genetically modified corn is usually Roundup-ready corn, and it's an alteration of the genes that make the stalk and stem of the corn, not the corn kernels, resistant to the Roundup chemical, so you can put less chemicals on the corn plant and keep people from having to ingest more chemicals, and it brings a better product to market. So there's really no way to tell that the genetically modified corn that is designed to control weeds around the corn stalk and so forth is any different than regular corn. And I see this time and again in these GMOs, that what is being done isn't altering the protein so much as it is altering resistance to various types of disease or chemical factors.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Nick. Allison, you know, I would like to define some of what we're talking about here. You know, the caller there, Nick, mentioned Roundup Ready corn, for instance, and soybeans. I know that there are two main fields of genetic modification or two main areas in which it's used mostly right now, and that's being insect resistant and herbicide resistant. Can you talk a little bit about that and help us define what that really means?
Yeah, sure. So that's quite correct in terms of our large production crops. Those are the two traits that are mostly on the market at the moment. And just to put the technology in perspective and the adoption in perspective, there's 17.3 million farmers around the globe that are growing genetically engineered crops, 17.3 million, on about 428 million acres. And it's really been an incredibly fast adoption of a technology. And so farmers are getting a benefit from this technology or they wouldn't keep buying it. And so why are they wanting to buy it? Well, first of all, the insect resistant you mentioned, that's a protein that's being expressed that's called the BT toxin, which actually kills lepidopterans or caterpillars, if you will. And basically what that enables you to do is produce a crop plant that's resistant to insect attack, or at least particularly lepidopteran insect attack. And so you don't have to spray insecticides for that particular variety of insect because the crop is protected from that. And there's been a tremendous drop as a result in insecticide use associated with the use of BT crops. The other product you mentioned is Roundup resistant or glyphosate resistant, and that basically enables weed control, which is a problem for all farming systems, be they conventional, GE, or organic. You know, there's different ways to approach weed control. One is to grow genetically engineered crops and use Roundup. If you don't do that, if you want to go with an all totally organic system, for example, then you have to plow them or hand weed them or do something, because weeds will always compete with the food that crops that we want to grow. So basically Roundup is a good pesticide or herbicide because its safety profile is very safe relative to some of the other herbicides that can be used to control weeds. And so it's enabled a substitution of a more benign herbicide rather than some of the less benign herbicides that have been used historically. And it also enables the use of no-till farming and has some other positive environmental benefits. And so I think if you look at the scientific data, it suggests that there have been very real environmental benefits to even those two products that you mentioned. There are other products in development, for example, drought-tolerant plants and nutrient-modified crops that are coming through the pipeline to market, but it's very expensive to bring these products to market, and that's really favoured the big multinational corporations bringing products to market and has put little academic labs really at a disadvantage to bring other novel products to market and products that might be in crops that aren't as widely grown as corn and soy.
So we spoke about herbicide resistance, and there's a big concern right now that GM crops with resistance to herbicides are creating also herbicide-resistant weeds. You know, they're being called superweeds. They're spreading quickly. I was reading in the journal Nature a recent article that charted their growth. And, for instance, in 2004, cotton farmers in just one county in Georgia found superweeds. But by 2011, they'd found superweeds in 76 Georgia counties. So are superweeds a legitimate environmental concern, and how are we fighting them?
Well, I love the term superweeds. It sounds like they have some, you know, magical property. Basically, they're resistant to Roundup, right, or glyphosate. They're not resistant to other herbicides. And so basically, whenever you use a herbicide or an insecticide, nature's always evolving to try to get around whatever it is you're trying to do to control weeds or insects. It's a constant battle, and it always has been, and it always will be. Herbicide resistance is not a new phenomenon, and so consequently, you know, an integrated pest management program requires alternating various approaches in terms of weed control so that you don't develop resistance to one. So if you've got a weed that's resistant to glyphosate, you can use a different herbicide. Like I said, some of those aren't as environmentally benign as glyphosate is, but you've got to have a rotating system to try to minimize the development of resistance, be it of insects or be it of weeds. But they're not somehow magically immune to all herbicides. They're going to be immune to the one that they've evolved to resist. And in this case, we're speaking specifically about glyphosate.
So Kansas City, we've been talking about genetic engineering and food. So are you concerned about eating genetically modified food, and, you know, why or why not? Again, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our look at the safety of genetically modified food, and we'll talk to a farmer about why he chose to go organic. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. We're joined now by Dr. Allison Van Inenam. She studies animal genomics and biotechnology at UC Davis. And in a few moments, we'll be joined by Chris Beckman. He's an organic farmer in Jefferson City, Missouri. But first, I want to continue here with Allison. Allison, what about long-term consequences? You know, I think opponents of genetically modified food would say that we can't possibly know the consequences of creating genetically engineered salmon, you know, in 100 years, because this technology hasn't been around for that long yet. So 100 years from now, you know, could we look back on this and point to this time as a major kind of environmental event?
Yeah, the long-term question is always a hard one to answer, because we really don't know that about any of the food we eat. There's certain new crops that are developed all the time, you know, broccolinis or whatever. You know, what are the long-term consequences of that? Well, you can't predict, right? And so I think you can look at the 20 years of history we've had with genetically engineered crops, and we haven't seen anything over those 20 years that suggests there's anything unique about this technology that's going to be dangerous. And I think you also have to look at it in the context of what are the current production systems that we're using and what are the risks involved with those. For example, in the case of this genetically engineered fish we're discussing, that's proposed to be grown in land-based tank facilities rather than open net pen aquaculture, which is where we currently get all our Atlantic salmon from. So all of our Atlantic salmon is imported from other countries, grown in net pens, and there are known ecological risks associated with that. There are frequent escapes of those fish into the ocean where they potentially could interbreed with wild salmon species, and there's a lot of environmental concerns associated with how we currently produce our aquacultured salmon. And this is actually an approach that could even be beneficial in terms of the environmental impact in 100 years' time, because it basically enables aquaculture to come onto a land-based facility and be done in what some would argue is a more sustainable fashion. And so I think there's pros and cons to every production system, and there's always going to be risks with every production system, the same way that there's going to be benefits with different production systems. And we currently have that choice in the marketplace in the U.S. And if you want to eat GE, then you can. And if you want to avoid it, then you can buy organic if that's your choice. And I think, you know, that vibrant marketplace and basically voluntary labeling, like was mentioned at the case of Whole Foods, gives consumers those options. So I think it's hard to know what the future holds, but 20 years of history to date shows no unanticipated or deleterious effects of eating genetically engineered food.
I'd like to go to another caller, so let's go to Drew from Olathe.
Hey, guys. I'm a vegan as well, and I look at some of this stuff. I heard what he said about Roundup. There are cases where they've actually sprayed more crops on there because they can. And I just look at this, and I think we need to think like the Iroquois. I think there's not enough long-term things. We need to look at the equivalent of how this is going to affect people seven generations down the road. What's going to happen to these kids' genetics when they eat this? Are they going to see a larger propensity for disorders or diseases? That's one of my biggest concerns. Keep in mind, I would term it genetic modification instead of engineering, because a lot of people have tried to use the argument it's been around for hundreds of years. That's Mendelian genetic engineering with a buffer of nature. If most people would look at the way they insert these genes, it's sometimes precise, sometimes not precise. You're looking at something that's a tapestry, and when you insert one gene in, you kind of throw one off and potentially cause worse effects than you'd ever expect.
Drew, I'm going to bring it back to Allison. Thanks so much for giving a call. Allison, I'm wondering, you know, there are obviously a lot of concerns with this process, and it's certainly a heated topic. So what kind of process does genetically engineered or modified food go through to make it to consumers? You know, who's regulating these products? We talked about that it's often very expensive and it takes a lot of time, but who's regulating and who's watching these things?
Well, that's a complicated question. I'll try to give you a brief answer, but there's basically three regulatory agencies associated with genetically engineered crops, the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA, depending upon what trait you're modifying. And specifically with regard to food safety, it's the FDA that looks at these crops. And they've looked at 148 transgenic crop events during the past 20 years that have been evaluated as part of the FDA review process. You'll often hear they don't go through regulatory review, and that is just not true. They go through very extensive regulatory review at the FDA, and basically what they've found is that of all those 148 transgenic events, that the product was substantially equivalent to the non-genetically engineered conventional counterpart, and that's true for every regulatory agency in the world that's ever looked at these crops. And so although I hear the caller's concern about unintended consequences, they just have not materialized. They haven't been found, despite the fact we've looked for 20 years. And so as a scientist, I have to go with that data and say that we are not seeing these unintended consequences. And I actually disagree that it's a random process. We know very well where the genes are. We can sequence the genomes nowadays and see exactly where those genes are. And so I think it's not true to say it's a random process and we don't have a lot of control over it. We have tremendous insight as to where that gene goes in, and we've done extensive food safety testing. And in fact, we've got multi-generational animal studies where we haven't seen untoward effects in those animals. And if you think about it, our livestock species production animals have been eating it for 20 years, and there's multiple generations now that have been eating it, and we're not seeing, you know, unanticipated events occurring in our livestock production systems. And if we saw chickens, for example, you know, that weren't growing well, boy, you would know about it. And we've got billions of chickens that are eating genetically engineered feed generation after generation, and we just haven't seen any untoward consequences as a result of eating it. So I think the data suggests that there is no concern with eating these products.
So if consumers want to educate themselves, can you think of some good resources about where one could go to really look at some of the data to understand some of the science behind it?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the internet is a very powerful tool. And I think the one thing that I always tell my kids is, you know, if you want to go and find factual information, go to a site that ends in .edu, education, because that'll take you to any of the university sites, or basically scientific organizations would have information on the factual aspects of genetically modified foods. And you can go and have a look at the American Medical Association's their statement on genetically engineered foods, in that they see them as, you know, as safe as conventional food. There are, you know, obviously activist sites that are going to have their own viewpoints as well, but I would just stick with a .edu because that's going to be a university site that's going to have science rather than information that hasn't been peer-reviewed and shown to be scientifically correct.
Let's bring in another caller. We're going to go to Steve from Lee's Summit. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. I've got three very, very short questions. I hope you'll write them down so they get answered. First of all, this lady here, who pays your salary? Do you get funding? Do your salary get paid by the chemical companies? I understand, contrary to what you're saying, what I've been able to gather, all the testing has been done by the chemical companies, Monsanto, et cetera, and we're basically relying upon their testing. There's no been any independent testing of any large magnitude. And I understand the third one is understand the people in charge of making the decisions on the information that gets out and the testing that work for the government are one's a former lawyer for Monsanto and the other one's a former lobbyist for Monsanto. So you would address those questions. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve. So, Allison, you've heard a lot of skepticism there. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I'll answer the first question. My salary is paid by the taxpayers of California because I work for the University of California, and my research is funded by the USDA, which is not a company. And, you know, I often you get this skepticism that if you're saying anything that's not negative about genetically engineered crops, you must be getting paid by industry. And I take almost a little bit of offense at that, really, because I think academic scientists really are more interested in the data, and it's not, you're not saying that what the data says is what the data says, and if that happens to be supportive of genetically engineered crops not being dangerous, I can't not say that, because my scientific integrity is my currency, if you will, and I would never do anything that would jeopardize that. So with regard to where the safety testing gets done, all of the products that we eat and drugs that we use, the safety testing is done by the company developing it. That's called product development, and I would surely hate to see the public sector, i.e. the taxpayers, have to pick up product development costs for any technology. I mean, I think that's the companies bringing it to market. What the FDA does is it independently reviews the data that the companies have paid to generate, the same way that, you know, when, I don't know, Merck develops a drug, they have to do all the patient testing and show that it's safe. They're the ones paying for it, not the FDA. And so that would be a really radical departure from who funds product development research if we want the public sector to do that, and we'd have to come up with the money to get that done. And with regard, I don't know the people at the FDA, but they're professional scientists. I guess I don't really buy into this conspiracy theory that everybody's bought off by Monsanto. I think that the data is so overwhelming in terms of the safety of this product that you can't refute it. It's 20 years and hundreds of scientific studies that have shown no difference. And I just think that, you know, if that many scientists are bought off by one company, it just kind of, you know, boggles your mind that there would be that sort of, that many scientists will be willing to lie if that's what the insinuation of this gentleman is, that we would, you know, somehow be complicit in a big lie. I just don't think that's a feasible proposition. And I just, knowing my academic colleagues, I just don't really believe that that's actually reality, and I think that the science is showing that these products aren't any different. And ideology aside, you know, if you look at the data, you will see that. And I shall, you know, anyone can go and look at the scientific data, and they are independent studies that have been done by scientists that aren't paid by Monsanto. So I think that there are data out there that are independent that show the same thing as what the industry studies do, and that is that there's no difference.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. Right now we're speaking with Dr. Allison Van Nienenam. She's a cooperative extension specialist of animal genomics and biotechnology at UC Davis. Kansas City, are you concerned about eating genetically modified food? We'd still want to hear from you. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's bring in another voice now. Christopher Beckman is the organic production manager at the Allen T. Busby Agriculture Farm. It's a research farm at Lincoln University in Jefferson City. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Chris, let's start off with a basic question here. What is organic farming, and how is it different from conventional farming?
Well, organic farming is going to be a system of farming where we're trying to, or we are raising, be it crops or livestock, or your small fruits even, without the use of chemicals, be it commercial fertilizers, your any type of herbicides or pesticides. We're going to go ahead and raise those crops without those types of inputs.
So by now, most of us are familiar with the organic label, but you know, what does that label mean? What are we getting if we go to our local grocery store and buy organic?
Well, as I said, basically, if you are going to go out and buy food that is labeled as organic, especially from a farm that has been certified as an organic farm, you can rest assured that that farm has been has raised that crop, that food, without the use of those inputs as far as any kind of commercial fertilizers or the pesticides and the herbicides. We're going to rely on other practices such as tillage to help control weeds, integrated pest management where we can utilize traps, et cetera, to control those pests without the use of pesticides. So there's going to be a couple of things going on there. You as a consumer will know, number one, that you are buying that food, utilizing those type of practices. You're also going to know what the source of that food is. There's a lot of interest among consumers now. They want to know who's producing their food. What is that source? And again, if you are buying from that organic farm with that label on it, you'll know that information.
So we've been talking about genetically modified and genetically engineered food this hour. Is all organic food free of genetically modified organisms, or does that not necessarily equate?
Yes. When we raise organic food, we will not use GMO seeds. When we do our production practices here at the Lincoln University farm, we do not raise the animals organically. We do those as pasture-based. However, any of the other small fruits we raise are going to be raised as organic, and as a result of that, we will not use any GMO seeds for the forages for the livestock or any of the plants that we bring in for our small fruits, such as blueberries. They will be produced organically as well without the use of any GMO seeds.
Dr. Vaninanam, I'd like to throw a question to you. There have been documented instances in which corn, for instance, that wasn't supposed to be genetically modified, they did tests on it and found genetically modified traits within their DNA. So how does this kind of thing happen, and is this a concern for organic farmers and for consumers trying to avoid GMOs?
So what you're talking about there is a thing called adventitious presence, and basically in agricultural production systems which take place outside, there's the possibility of cross-pollination or occurring. And so the way that that's handled with genetically engineered product, the same way as it is with other seeds that you don't want to get mixed up, is you have a tolerance level. Zero is an unenforceable level of purity for anything at any time. I think we have a certain level for rat poo and insects in our seed supply too, because zero is just not a possible level. So there are practices that farmers can undergo to minimize the possibility of cross-pollination. So for example, if you're planting a corn crop next to an organic neighbor, you'll talk to them and make sure that your two crops are not pollinating at the same time, so that you know there's no possibility for cross-pollination. So there are things that you can do to enable the coexistence of different production systems whilst allowing both to still exist. And in the case of the organic system that we were just talking about, as Christopher mentioned, they're not allowed to use genetically engineered seed, and so you want to try and minimize any possibility of genetically engineered seed or becoming involved with that product. But there is no, it's a process-based production label. In other words, I've used the organic process to grow this product, but it doesn't say it's got 0% GE. You've done everything possible to minimize the possibility of having GE in there, but it's not basically a product verification of 0% GE, because that's just not going to be a possible standard to enforce in production agriculture, which takes place outside. And farmers have handled coexistence for years with different crops that they don't want cross-pollinating. You know, different coloured corn kernels, for example. You don't want to have blue corn contaminating yellow corn, and you don't want seedless mandarins or seeded mandarins contaminating seedless ones. And so, you know, I think it's just a matter of working together with your neighbours to ensure you both can use the production process that best suits your interests and your market. And farmers have done it for generations.
So, Chris, let me ask you, how do you respond to that? And are you thinking, do you work to actively avoid, you know, cross-contamination, that kind of thing?
Well, in our situation here at the Busby Farm, we do not raise any crops, row crops such as corn or soybeans, where we would have as much direct risk of cross-contamination. At this time, our primary crops are going to be the blueberries we have and also some organic vegetables. So we don't have close exposure to any of the GMO plants here. However, I would say that, yes, we have coexisted, as Allison said, but to insinuate that there has been no cross-contamination or that's not a major concern, I would have to disagree with that. I think there's a long history of situations. If you think about the Starlink situation where there was some contamination of a GMO corn into the general food that was not intended to be into the food source, there have been cases and situations when there have been contamination. Likewise, from a organic farmer standpoint, where they are not using GMOs, no question there is always a potential for cross-contamination, but the very existence of that cross-contamination has also led to a lot of lawsuits in between some of the bigger corporations that have the GMO seed patents and the private producers. So, and those are some very real and very considerable risks to those type of farmers.
Chris, I would like to ask a kind of general organic food question. You know, consumers do have a choice often now to buy organic food, but it's often much more expensive than non-organic food and often out of the price range for many shoppers. So that's kind of one of the downsides of organic food, isn't it? It's price prohibitive for a big swath of the population.
I would not agree with the statement that it's cost prohibitive. In many cases, yes, it is going to be a little bit more costly than some of the other produced foods. However, just last week, when you look at some of the comments made by Tom Vilsack, who's the director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, just earlier this week, actually, Mr. Vilsack pointed out that when you look at our agriculture as a whole, currently the organic industry is a $30 billion industry, and that in the last 10 years we have seen that is actually the fastest growing sector of all of agriculture, which I think is really impressive when you think of how big of an industry agriculture is. And that currently we're seeing that the retail value of the organic industry grew about 9.5% to where it is now at $31.4 billion. So you can see that this is a sizable industry with the organic movement. Again, when a consumer that knows that they are getting products that have been produced without the use of those type of chemicals typically are going to be willing to pay more for those type of products. And I think that's for a couple reasons. Again, we are a research farm here, so I appreciate what Allison is saying as far as trying to protect the integrity of the research. And it is a very complex situation when you are dealing with scientific research. However, one thing I would point out, to make a general statement, which Allison did several times, to say that there is, quote-unquote, no, and I say no, proof that there are any detrimental effects of consumption of the GMOs, I think would be inaccurate. There are a lot of studies that have been done that raise questions regarding GMOs. Admittedly, some of those have been dismissed as bad science. However, I would question, and I'm not the one that is qualified to make that judgment, but I don't know that all of those studies could be, quote, bad science. And the other thing is to keep in mind that Allison brought up, I think it was earlier, when we look at the GMOs, we consider them to be substantially equivalent to a lot of the non-GMO crops. which the one issue you have to be aware of, a lot of concern raised there, is the fact that by considering them to be substantially equivalent, then the USDA, FDA also do not regulate them quite as closely as they otherwise would. Now, I'm not insinuating that FDA, EPA, and the USDA are not doing their job, but I am pointing out the fact that a lot of the concern by consumers is the fact that if we are calling them substantially equivalent, we just need to make sure that we are doing due diligence in assessing their impacts.
Chris, let me stop you there. Allison, I apologize. We only have about 30 more seconds, but do you have just a quick response to that? I know that might be impossible.
I'll just speak really quickly. You know, I think the studies that are brought up that have been very sensationalized in the media have very egregious scientific flaws, and I think that, you know, any independent scientist has just basically said that, you know, that it's just really bad science, and there's hundreds of studies that show no difference, and that's what the consensus of the scientific literature is, and that's what I'm going to go with as a scientist, is the consensus of the literature.
Thank you both so much. We'll have a lot more information at kcur.org. Our guests today were Abby Swanson, who's a reporter for Harvest Public Media based at KBIA in Columbia. We also had Dr. Allison Van Inenam, a cooperative extension specialist in animal genomics and biotechnology at UC Davis, as well as Chris Beckman, the organic production manager at Allen T. Busby Agriculture Farm in Jefferson City, Missouri. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore the best places to eat outdoors with the Food Critics. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Suzanne Hogan with Claire McInerney. Kim Noble is our announcer, and Bill Anderson is our executive producer. Up to Date is next with allergies, indoors, outdoors, and everywhere. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. You can find me on Twitter at JeremyHPM. This is Central Standard.